Hello and welcome. You're listening to Fourth Estate, the show where journalists talk journalism. Coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on the Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. My name is Peter Frey and I'm the co-director of the Centre for Media Transition at the University of Technology Sydney, and my producer today is Anthony Dockrell. Today we have a one-on-one special with a special guest, Eric Jensen, the editor-in-chief of the Saturday paper, the flagship of the Swartz Media's ever-growing empire, which now takes in the monthly, the quarterly essay, Australian foreign affairs, and a few more things on the way. Eric, welcome.
Peter, thank you for having me.
Okay, so how long has it been, the Saturday paper? About 5 years, right? And you've been there virtually every step of the way.
Yes, for about 2 years before it launched, to plan it and bring it into shape. And then we launched March 1, 2014, which is a little bit more than 5 years ago now.
Yeah, I remember having a conversation with you five, six, maybe even 7 years ago about the Saturday paper in a pub in Surrey Hills. You were about to go to Melbourne. Is it what you thought it was going to be?
It is, happily. I was looking recently at a notebook where the early sketches for what the paper would become were sort of gathered up. And the paper is miraculously, I think, very much like the title that was in my head before it began. Mm. And the audience is very much like the audience that we were hoping to find. And the journalism we're doing, I think, is very much and ever more like the journalism we were hoping to do.
So was that just kind of gut instinct? I mean, around that time, just for our listeners to remember, there was, you know, just been mass redundancies at the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. There was a real set, The Guardian, you know, wasn't really here. There was a kind of sense that there was a kind of space in the market for something like the Saturday paper. Was that a kind of gut, or was there kind of some science behind that?
I'd like to tell you that there was science, Peter.
Yes, I'm sure you would.
There's what it is, and it's something that drives any number of the things that we do here at Swartz Media, a real belief, an optimistic belief in the seriousness of Australian people, mm-hmm. And a belief that if you make journalism that is serious, that is built around an ethos of quality, there will be an audience for it. And really, the research we did in market wasn't much more than that, more than believing in people.
Well, it's kind of proved to be true because, correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, Swartz Media, in a sense, has kind of crept up on us. I mean, there was the Saturday paper and before that, the monthly and such like, but it seemed kind of small once, but now it's kind of a bit bigger, quite a lot bigger. Was that part of the plan? The sort of this kind of gradual growth rather than, you know, it really is with the Australian Foreign Affairs and the new podcast, which we'll talk about in a minute, it really is quite a media empire now.
Look, I think everything that we start here, we intend to be bigger than the last title. So the Saturday paper's audience is bigger than the monthly's audience. 7 a.m. our new podcast will be bigger still than the Saturday paper. And the experience is that when one title grows, the others grow. So, mm-hmm. you know, looking at the last results from Roy Morgan for year-on-year growth with just the Saturday paper and the monthly, for instance, they're both up in terms of audience. I think the monthly's up about 11%. The Saturday paper's up about 16 or 17%. And they're commanding an audience now that is sizable and serious.
Mm. Well, we'll get back to the advertising plug later in the show as well, because I'd like to talk about the new podcast. But let's, before we get started into, you know, issues of journalism of the day, we need to talk a little bit more about you. I mean, you were kind of a wunderkind. I mean, maybe it's an overused word, but you're a bit of a wunderkind at the Sydney Morning Herald. You joined at the age of 8, weren't you?
I started writing for the Herald when I was 15, but then I started on the news staff when I was 18.
Incredible. You were the youngest at the time, I think. Is that right?
I was. And I think, one editorship before yours.
Indeed. I was obviously a very wise editor. I remember at the time, I mean, you were, and there was a sort of a bit of a trend to recapture a sense of you know, that kind of spirit of cadets and that kind of getting really smart young people from school instead of, you know, slightly wizened, you know, journalists or graduates, I suppose. And there was a big challenge for you, but you were sort of born to it. I know I'm blowing smoke up your bottom here, but you were kind of born to journalism. Did you always want to be a journo?
It's the only thing I've ever done, but it's not something I was always certain about doing. You know, I don't have a romantic childhood story to tell you about, you know, being six and starting a family newspaper or anything like that. It's not something that I did. I think, you know, when I was a kid, I thought that I would be a scientist probably.
There's still time.
There is still time.
Yes.
You can't really practice science in the dilettante fashion that you can be a journalist, unfortunately.
True.
Maybe you can. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe we should try it. Dilettante scientist. Yeah, it's a good idea. Anyway. Think,
you know, the thing about that time, and, you know, this stepping into a newsroom as big as what the Herald's newsroom was then, as an 18-year-old with, you know, very little experience, there are enough people around to learn from the institution. And that's something that's really, you know, doesn't happen in newsrooms anymore because newsrooms aren't big enough to do it.
Mm. Yeah, one of the great tragedies and not spoken about enough, to be honest. Just staying on you, apart from the Saturday paper and your activities at Schwartz and the Herald, you are the author of a very good biography on the dear departed Australian artist Adam Cullen, which has become a biopic, which people may have read the book, of course, but they may have also seen the biopic called Acute Misfortune. I mean, Cullen was another kind of, I wouldn't say a wunderkind, but he sort of was a wonderfully eccentric man who, among other things, shot you in the leg when you were writing the book.
That's right.
So this is immersive journalism or just the problems of hanging around with a boozed up, sort of slightly DF'd kind of artist?
I think it's a number of things. A big part of it was being very young and very anxious to succeed, not really understanding what journalism was and putting myself into situations that I thought resembled immersion journalism, but in reality were probably exploitative and abusive.
On his part to you?
Mm.
Right. Yeah. So you have regret?
I don't have regrets. I just don't wish to be romantic about that period of time, but it is also how I learnt to be a writer, and in all sorts of curious ways, I'm grateful for it.
Hmm. Okay, all right. Well, I'll leave it at that. But it's an interesting. It sounds like you reflected on it quite a bit. It's useful to learn from these things, right?
I think. I mean, you don't learn anything when you write a book, but when you write a film, you do, because suddenly, for the first time, in this story at least, I had to start considering the motives of the character that was based on me, and so I couldn't hide any longer the way that in journalism we are allowed so often to hide because we're discouraged from being part of the story ourselves.
How was you in the movie?
Who was me?
No, how were you? I mean, how did you feel the movie represented you?
I found the process of giving the story across to the director quite difficult. But when I saw Toby Wallace, who plays the character based on me, and I saw his great sense of feeling and care for the person that I used to be, I was incredibly struck by the fact that I didn't have at that time a great deal of empathy for myself or the person that I used to be. And it was really quite moving to see someone else bothering to care about that person.
Hmm. Okay. Interesting. Very interesting. Before we get to journalism, you live in Melbourne. You're on the phone from Melbourne. I did want to ask you a quick Melbourne-ish sort of question, which is, do we not have the right to call an AFL umpire a green maggot?
Although I live in Melbourne, I'm not from Melbourne, so I can't speak to any of the cultural practices of this town. I think it's probably not ideal, but I really can't represent myself as having a strong opinion.
Mm. Although it's interesting, isn't it, when you live in Melbourne, as you do and as I have done, love Melbourne, I mean, it kind of comes out at you, doesn't it, the kind of culture of AFL. Really, it's hard to avoid, even in the, you know, the bookish parts of St Kilda, it's hard to avoid.
It's true, even in Carlton. people are want to talk of it.
Hmm. So green maggot, unacceptable.
I don't know. Look, I really don't know.
Okay. Well,
I just think abusing umpires probably, you know, it's probably not the worst thing. It's also probably not good.
Hmm. Fair enough. Okay. Let's talk about journalism, which is what we're here to do. I wanted to go back a little bit to the results of the digital news report, which came out last week, and we covered it on the show with the lead author of the local part of that, Caroline Fisher from the University of Canberra. And I'm asking this because it goes to what you do and what I've done and wish to do again. And that is, you know, what do news consumers think about journalism? So the kind of two or three key takeouts of the digital news report. One was Australians seem to be quite massive avoiders of news. Number two was that interest in news is falling. And three was that many Australians think the news is negative and not relevant to their lives. What do you think about that? It seems to me that those reports in the Brawl basically say that we're getting it wrong.
Yeah, look, I think the problem with those reports is they pretend there is one audience and they pretend there is one type of news. Mm-hmm. And I think there have always been myriad forms of news and myriad audiences for them. And, you know, I think there's a figure in that report that says 65% of Australians are sick of reading about politics. Well, 35% of Australians are a large enough audience to build an impressive news organisation.
Mm. And Karen Middleton, your political correspondent, spoke at the launch of that report, and she made the point, and I think it's a very fair point, is that when we talk about sick of politics, what are we talking about? Because politics that is obviously intrinsic to our being, intrinsic to democracy, intrinsic to civil life. It's possibly the way we do it, which I suppose is where, again, a bit of a plug, but where the Saturday paper tries to make a difference as well.
Yeah, look, I just think it goes to what I was saying earlier, which is if we're optimistic about audiences, and we really, you know, instead of treating audiences with cynicism and pretending that they're unsophisticated or that they're, you know, desperate for fast and cheap news, if we treat them with some dignity, and I think that we should, then I think the findings of reports like this would look slightly different.
Mm. Do you think reading news is a civil obligation?
I don't think there is an obligation to be informed, but I think without being informed, you can't have you know, a truly rich society. And it's a little bit, to my mind, all of this kind of traces back to a fundamental mistake large newsrooms made with the advent of the internet. The response of newsrooms across the world to the collapse in classified revenues when the internet arrived was to decide that because the internet was fast, news needed to be fast. And because doing things quickly meant doing them less well, news wouldn't be very good any longer. Mm. And it's taken, you know, a couple of decades for news organizations to properly turn themselves back from that miscalculation.
Yeah, no, you're dead right about that. I mean, and it's still obviously very prevalent, that attitude that news has to be fast. And not just in the commercial sector. I mean, you know, the average ABC journalist would write three or four times more stories or broadcast more stories than they ever did.
Yeah, and there's obviously tension in the model to fund journalism, and that means that you're asking fewer people to do more things, and, you know, there's all of this kind of pressure. But the audience hasn't told us that they want things to be any different.
Mm.
You know, and every time we embrace a new platform, and obviously we need to be embracing new platforms, we shouldn't be changing what we do as journalists. But, you know, the platform changes, but journalism doesn't. That's my view, but it's not one that's always shared by others.
No, and I suppose in terms of Schwartz Media, you know, Schwartz Media, named after Maurice Schwartz, who has made his money out of property development. I mean, if you didn't have Maurice, would we have the Saturday paper or the monthly or the quarterly essay or any of that? I mean, he's a true believer.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. The Saturday paper has paid for itself from launch. The monthly turns a profit. All of our publications look after themselves or make money. But if you didn't have a leader like Maurice for an organisation like this, so someone who actually just really believes in news, then I don't know that any of these titles would have started in the first instance. That said, they've all started in a way that has made them sustainable. So it's not a question of being supported or underwritten by a proprietor, but you do need a proprietor who really believes in what you're doing.
So what you're talking about really is a combination of someone who's got a vision or, you know, loves the idea of news media and also is a sound business person.
Yeah, and you know, any organization is helped by having a proprietor who, if things went wrong, might be able to help tide over startups. You know, various startups need capital to keep them going, but it just hasn't been the case with the titles we've launched.
So you've been paid every week that you've been at Schwartz Media.
and occasionally other people have been as well.
Really incredible. Amazing. Let's talk about a deeper, well, an ethical issue, which is what's happening in New Zealand. As you're probably aware, the key publishers in New Zealand, the five key publishers and media organizations, have banded together and agreed not to spread hate speech and white supremacist ideology from the reporting of the alleged Christchurch shooter, Brenton Tarrant. So at a hearing, Tarrant pleaded not guilty to the mass killing, and the trial was set down for May next year. So we don't really know what the effect of this pact between New Zealand's five leading news organizations will be. But interestingly, last week when he pleaded not guilty, the story was significantly downplayed on the homepage of New Zealand news organizations. And as I say, there's more to come. What do you think about that pact?
Yeah, look, I've seen the pact itself, read the pact. I think it's an entirely reasonable list of principles to be signed up to. I've seen it reported elsewhere as an agreement to censor court proceedings or, you know, to not report the trial. And that's not what's being asked for here at all. What news organizations in New Zealand have signed up to doing is not gratuitously reporting hate speech, not using their court reporting or allowing their court reporting to become a platform for hate speech, and not broadcasting or reproducing what could be white supremacist or white nationalist symbols that might be made during the course of a trial. So, you know, the sort of the Nazi salutes that we saw after the Norwegian massacre.
Yeah, and
we won't be seeing those.
So, okay, that's fair enough. But, I mean, isn't one of our jobs basically to bear witness and call out, you know, you've got to see evil to understand it, don't you? So isn't there a danger in censoring it?
Well, I think there's a greater danger in uncritical reproduction of it, and this is the tension, this issue. I think it's very easy for us as journalists to pretend that free speech is an absolute principle, and when we sign up to it, we need not then interrogate our actions. But I believe we really actually do need to stop and ask ourselves if our journalism can be regarded as useful and responsible, because I think that's what it needs to be. And I don't think our capacity to cover the trial in New Zealand is held back by deciding not to create and share images of white nationalism or to allow hate symbols to be spread through our pages or online or through broadcast. And I think it goes beyond that. I actually think that I think the pact that has been brought together by news organisations in New Zealand is a small part of what we should be looking at. You know, more troubling to me than what we might hear in that court case and what we might see in images of white power symbols and so on, is the fact that many of the principles of the manifesto and the pact says very clearly that that the manifesto will be avoided in their reporting. Mm. Tarrant's manifesto is most troubling for the fact that many of the ideas within it have appeared in an uncritical fashion on op-ed pages in this country and around the Anglosphere. And it's that we need to be talking about as news organisations. It's not whether or not we need to be sensitive about covering a racist terrorist.
Well, okay. How would we best go about that? I mean, I hear what you're saying, but how do we
We start to say, do we use our op-ed pages and our news reporting and our panel shows and so on to offer uncritical platform to to violent and divisive views in a way that helps simply to propagate those views.
So do you think there needs to be a new kind of form of standards? I mean, there's a bunch of standards, there's a bunch of rules and regulations and obligations on news media, and we've seen these police press raids recently. Do you think there needs to be a new, as it were, a new debate about what we can and can't do?
Absolutely, and I think that's largely because the standards that you and I were trained as journalists around and are comfortable with were written by people who look just like you and I, Peter. This is not just a question of race, it's also a question of class and gender. Basically, everything that we hold to be true as journalists came from newsrooms that were wholly white, wholly male, and where the staffs were drawn almost exclusively from private schools. And you know, then we have a press council that can look at a Mark Knight cartoon that is, you know, that clearly contains a racial caricature, and say that it's not racist, because there is no feedback from people who actually experience racism.
Interesting.
Well, so I think as an industry, we have a huge problem, not just with diversity of hiring, but with appreciating the shortcomings of our capacity to make decisions about what certain things mean.
Okay, so what's the first step on this?
Look, very basic things. The Press Council shouldn't make rulings on issues of race without consulting people of colour.
I'm sure they make efforts to do that. Do they not? I mean, my experience of it is limited as it is, but I was on it for a while. It tried to do that.
It tries to do that, but I cannot see how we could reasonably look at the Serena Williams cartoon, for instance, and say, on the basis of the Herald Sun's claims that this cartoon is part of a style Mark Knight has drawn in for some time, and that the criticism came from overseas, to say on these two points, well, fair enough, the cartoon's okay, does suggest that there is, you know, even if there is an attempted consultation, there's a limited reckoning with what myriad people of colour were saying about that cartoon.
Is that okay? So they're offended, but, you know, we could use the rest of the show talking about this, I suppose, but do we have a right to offend?
Of course, but there is an accountability for being offensive. I mean, a press council ruling against Mark Knight's cartooning would have encouraged the Herald Sun to reckon with that cartoon and perhaps apologise for its content and think again about running uncritical racist cartoons. Mm. It's not going to stop Mark Knight drawing cartoons. He's not being fined. He's not being imprisoned. He's not having his liberties affected. He's being asked to be responsible.
Hmm. Okay,
he's being asked to think. I think this is the other thing. Hmm. Now, we pretend when we talk about the way in which the press engages with issues of, you know, prominence and responsibility over hate speech and other tense aspects of our reporting. Mm-hmm. We pretend that that there are absolutes here. It's, you know, you either can draw racist cartoons or you're not allowed to draw cartoons at all. This is the line that they're on.
It's reductive, you're saying,
And what's actually being asked for is a little bit of criticality around what we do as journalists, so that we don't just point to pre-established ethics and say, well, that's what we've always done and it's how we'll keep doing it. That we look at those ethics and say, do they still stand? Are they sophisticated? Were they written by a broad range of people, and can we actually look at them and say that all of them are absolute?
Your point is that we can't really begin to have this conversation until we have a different way of measuring it, or different standards, or we have a more inclusive way of thinking about it.
Or until we start saying, actually, let's think about all these things. And, a lot of the ethics that our industry is based around will remain the same, but I think everything needs to be reexamined.
Hmm. Okay. Let's talk about politics, more earthy politics than perhaps where we've been for 5 seconds there. But so the government's been re-elected, and it would not be controversial to say they outlined no particular agenda over and above giving everyone more money, a tax cut, and that everyone should have a fair go. Do you think the media, how would you rate the media's job during the election? I mean, I'm making the assumption of a kind of a homogenous group. It's not an homogenous group, I agree. But in the, you know, on balance, did the media do its job during the election campaign?
Look, I think that, again, Peter, is a really complicated question. I think there was some very good reporting during the campaign. I think the problem is that the government decided it didn't really need to open itself to great scrutiny. It didn't need to put up a complex plan.
Isn't that our job, though?
What's that?
Isn't that the job of the news media?
Well, I think the Press in this country pointed out time and again that the coalition was running on a threadbare platform, and I think a lot of what was said by coalition MPs that was not truthful was criticised. And I think you look at the Angus Taylor Waterlooses story. There was some terrific reporting around that during the campaign. The public didn't seem very much to care.
Well, that's always a problem, isn't it? I mean, look, you know, did the public care about the Waterlooses? Well, a small section of it did, would be the answer, right?
If the question, though, is about did the media fail by not picking from the outset that the coalition were going to win, I think that's an interesting question also. And I think for a long time I've held the view that published polling is irresponsible. I think it's irresponsible to publish polling between elections, and I think it's irresponsible to publish it during elections.
So we shouldn't publish polling full stop?
That's my view.
Well, it saves a lot of money for a start.
It would save a lot of money, but you know, more pertinently, it would stop focus groups of a couple of hundred people setting agenda on policy issues, and it would stop governments and oppositions focusing on news poll to decide who should be leading.
But how do we, I don't disagree with you, but how do we then listen to people? Because obviously polls are a shorthand way of listening to people, or getting the temperature of the nation type thing. So how do we, what's the alternative to that?
Well, journalists and journalism need to be engaged in communities and need to be reporting the reality of communities. I think, and obviously there's a huge amount of hand-wringing after the Trump election about the fact that big media companies in the US failed to realize what more than half the country was feeling. But I don't think we should be outsourcing that to polling companies. We should be doing that in our reporting. We should be going out and trying to understand the countries in which we live and making sure that our reporting extends well beyond the boundaries of our own experience. I don't think telephoning 300 people and asking them what they think of Muslim immigration and then running a story off page one saying that we would like Muslim immigration to cease is responsible. And pretending that because it's been done by a polling company, it's somehow got great efficacy. I don't think that is good journalism.
So do you think you'll ever run the Herald Sun or The Age?
Someone like me?
Yes, with that attitude.
I don't know that I'd have any desire to run the Herald.
Yeah, I kind of knew you were going to say that somehow. But anyway, let's talk about the news media and its future. Where do you see growth? I mean, we mentioned your new podcast. Obviously, podcasting is going gangbusters. Where else, if I were a young journalist or young journalism student thinking about this industry, knowing broadly, they've seen cutbacks or closures at WinTV only yesterday. Sometimes it looks pretty grim. How do you instill confidence? What should we be doing and looking for growth? Where do we look for growth?
Again, for me, it's about pulling away from particular medium and just saying, get very good at telling stories and get very interested in how to tell stories and, really practice your craft. And it doesn't matter if that's how to tell audio stories or how to write for online. I mean, the capacity to actually tell a story, we think that it's a common trait. It's not. There are not that many people who are practicing journalism in this country who are also very good at telling stories. And I wish there were more. And I wish people who look to become journalists saw that as the base unit of what we do, because it is.
Telling stories that connect people.
Well, it's not. I mean, I'm not even being romantic about it. I just mean really getting interested in the structure of storytelling, getting interested in, you know, how we convey information, making stories work. Mm-hmm. And it's not about, you know, connecting to people necessarily. It's not about going out into the regions or, you know, pretending that you need to find some curious individuals for the center of a story. It's about sort of saying, you know, how do I put words in whatever format, one after the other, in a way that actually carries meaning and has purpose.
Hmm. No, I think that's great advice. Great advice to anyone listening, not just would-be journalists, by the way.
It's also all I ever, you know, I've never learned anything more than how to write a 300-word news story. And then everything I've done from that has just been putting 300-word stories in order until they get longer and turn into, you know, essays or books or films or whatever it might be.
Mm. Which does beg the question, what next for Erik Jensen?
I hope that, you know, the Saturday paper and the monthly continue to do well. The podcast that we've just launched, 7 a.m., is doing really well. I think the kind of stories we're telling and the way in which we're telling those stories is already a month in where I expected us to be, probably 6 months in. So I sort of see that can only get better.
You're not quite answering that question, though.
Well, yeah, see, you're forgetting that I think all these things are me, Peter.
Oh, no, maybe I don't forget that. Yes, okay. They're all you.
That's one of the problems with me. As you know, you took me from the cradle to become a journalist, and then I realized I've got nothing else.
I'm sure you've got other things you could do. I mean, you want to be a scientist, is, you know.
Well, I did as a child. That
not anymore.
That desire left me.
Right. So the desire, where does it burn brightest? Just to keep telling great stories and growing audiences, they'll listen to them or hear them or read them.
Well, and finding ways to let other people tell big stories. And, you know, just everything I do, I think, is about being optimistic with what's possible. And the more I can find ways for other people also to be optimistic and for the pessimism and worse, the cynicism that so invades our industry, from finding ways to kind of shake that out. That's what interests me as a journalist.
Erik Jensen, thank you so much for your time. I wish you all the very best. It's been wonderful talking to you. You know, I can only wait to see what, you know, next pops out the pipeline.
I've got a quarterly essay out on Monday.
Oh, do you? What's it about?
It's about the election that just happened.
Oh, what's your take out? Give us a scoop.
I followed both leaders closely on the campaign, and the essay, kind of by surprise, ended up being about how much insecurity, especially the insecurity of Bill Shorten, is a leadership trait that we don't value in this country and that might actually be what would heal a country as insecure and incomplete as Australia.
Interesting. And yet Bill Shorten lost.
Well, insecure... We haven't really run insecure leaders in the make of Bill Shorten before. Shorten's, you know, really quite a unique individual to be leading the party to an election, and we, you know, we couldn't elect him because he was insecure.
Right,
is my view. And yet, if we keep electing confident people, we won't really look at reckoning with how that confidence comforts only half the country.
What's the title of the essay?
It's called The Prosperity Gospel.
Nice. Well, we should look forward to that. Erik Jensen, Editor-in-Chief of Saturday Paper, essayist, author, film star. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you for listening to The Fourth Estate. This edition was recorded at the studios of 2SER and heard across the country on the Community Radio Network. Make sure you subscribe to The Fourth Estate on your favorite podcast app so you can hear us talk about media and politics and a few things in between at your leisure. And we'll be back with more next week. But in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us on Twitter, where our handle is FourthEstateAU. Many thanks to my producer, Anthony Dockrell. My name is Peter Frey, and thank you so much for listening.